Welcome to this week's Third Opinion Podcast. This week, we will continue our conversation with NPR media critic Eric Deggans, talking about Kanye West and Dave Chappelle with their anti-Semitic remarks and why the African-American and Jewish communities are having problems relating to each other. We'll also talk about a disturbing survey from the Anti-Defamation League showing an alarming rise in anti-Semitism, and we'll learn why anti-Semitism affects us all. Don't forget you can get your Third Opinion podcast wherever you download your podcasts. And now, this week's Third Opinion Podcast. Good afternoon, or good evening, or good morning, whenever you're listening to us. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions on WKDW in the podcast. I am Mike Deason.
I am Lorene Jaffe.
And we are delighted you are with us. The past 2 weeks, we did best of shows. We're back to the new year, taking on all sorts of new issues.
New, and but old. I mean, like, sometimes,
new I guess, old, you know, right,
doesn't change. It's always there.
Well, it is. It's very upsetting. Lorene and I were talking before we started the show. There are so many anti-Semitic incidents that are continuing to grow. I don't know where to start, Lorene. What do you want to say?
I feel like they're becoming so much more blatant at the college level and the university level. I mean, I feel like there's a new boldness in the anti-Israel, anti-Semitic movement in this nation. And you see it probably most clearly on college campuses. And as you and I were talking before we came on the air, this one professor at George Washington University, she's a professor in the psychology department, the graduate level, and she teaches a mandatory course on diversity, where she literally has singled out and attacked and in essence demoralized the Jewish students.
Laurie Sheehy is her name. We ought to say it just
right
to warn people.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you have a child at George Washington University, they'll be required to take this course. And it is very concerning for Jews. I mean, she has been very openly anti-Israel, anti-Semitic in her social media. So this isn't a surprise to the university when she talks about, you know, F Israel, F Jews, F your money, F, you know, you don't have a right to exist. I mean, she has openly disparaged Israelis and Jews that are in this class, demoralized them in front of their colleagues. When these students went to complain to the university about her anti-Semitism, she opened a complaint against them in retaliation. This is important because if you're a psychology student, you now have a professor who is responsible for your master's degree opening a complaint against you as a student. That is very damaging potentially.
And of course, George Washington said, we'll jump in and investigate and make sure this doesn't happen to any other student throughout the rest of the semester, right?
No, they didn't.
No, I'm being facetious, yes.
Of course they
don't. It's from the corner of sarcasm that this comes, yes.
So George Washington University is just sitting on their hands going, oh, well, you know, complaints been submitted to the U.S. Department of Education for civil rights. We'll see what they decide to do. So George Washington University apparently has no qualms with this openly anti-Semitic professor. And all you have to do is sit in one of her classes and hear her for 5 minutes or check out one of her social media pages, who is openly demoralizing, attacking Jewish students in front of all their colleagues, attacking them. And they're like, we're not going to do anything at this time. So that is highly alarming. And I think, unfortunately, Mike, I feel like it has become so pervasive and so commonplace on college campuses. And it's alarming. I think that's the biggest alarm bell, really, just how bold these Jew haters and Israel haters have become without any fear of retaliation. Although, you know, we do know that at least I think the Department of Justice, based upon the U.S. Department of Education, are opening investigation against Berkeley Law School, which you and I have been talking about for years now, regarding their anti-Semitism. So very happy to finally see some steps taken there, but who knows what the result will be. But that was really very scary.
Well, yeah, but you know what I found even more concerning was the Anti-Defamation League released a survey this week showing growing belief in Jewish tropes by a huge percentage of the population. Something like, what is it,
85% of Americans, or as many as 285 million people in this country, believe at least one anti-Semitic trope. And the percentages are crazy. So they said at least 26% of the population believes that Jews have too much power in the business world. 21% believe Jews don't care about anyone other than themselves. 20% believe Jews are more willing than others to use shady practices to get what they want. 53% believe Jews will go out of their way to hire other Jews. I will note there might actually be some truth to that. I think some, you know, there is, sometimes.
I wouldn't disagree in the fact that if you have a friend or a cousin or something
exactly.
like that,
you want to help them out.
I would have to agree with that.
And yeah. Another 23% that Israel gets away with anything because we control the media. And 39% believe Jews are more loyal to Israel than to the United States. I mean, I think this really is alarming. And 20% of Americans believe six or more of those tropes. So this is up. And I think because the numbers are so staggering, this really sort of crosses all boundaries. I mean, you know, we get the radical left, we get the radical right, we get like just what's happening on college campuses. And I really feel like this is a perfect example of those students sitting in that classroom being indoctrinated regarding Jew hatred by that psychology professor, Laura Shahi at George Washington University. It's a perfect example. Where do Americans get these ideas about Jews controlling the world? I don't know, from professors like her. That's where. I mean,
I was going to say the only, I can't say it's a bright note, but differential was I thought younger students were able to separate their dislike for Israel, which doesn't make you happy, from American Jews or Jews in general. I thought that was part of the survey.
I think that's an irrelevant distinction because that anti-Israelism is the new form of anti-Semitism. Like if we can get you to hate Israel, which is home to over 50% of the world's Jewish population, and somehow convince you it's not anti-Semitic, then you could be like, oh, I don't hate Jews, I just hate Israel. I mean, that is BS. That is like the new modern day anti-Semitism. So, I mean, you know, I think that's BS. I think the other thing that was interesting, you know, the other college thing, you know, at University of Michigan, I guess the vice president, Harris was going to be speaking at the University of Michigan last week. And one of the quote unquote, and I say it lightly, pro-Palestinian, you know, I say that facetiously because they're not really pro-Palestinian. They're just anti-Israel.
They're anti-Israel. That's exactly right.
The student group called Students Allied for Freedom and Equality were out there protesting her, accusing her of committing genocide because she supports Israel. So, you know, I mean, and that's the extremism, right? It's like, let's use words like genocide that don't apply, but we know that they are words that conjure up emotions and concepts and people and in order to, you know, demonize Israel. And so we're going to accuse them of genocide. I mean, it's just, this is what's happening every day on college campuses. No words. So welcome to 2023.
You know, but the point is that anti-Semitism obviously affects all of us who are Jewish, but it affects the entire world. It truly does. Prejudice of any kind does. A point driven home to me this week was from a TED Jr. talk by a young man named Jasper Vida, who talks about why anti-Semitism really strikes home to every person alive. Let's take a listen.
One of my earliest memories is from when I was about 5 years old. right here in Oakland. It was Rosh Hashanah, one of the most important holidays in the Jewish year, and I was going to services with my family. Surrounded by hundreds of other members of my synagogue, I remember running my fingers through my chair's dark brown upholstery and sitting calmly as I listened to the chorus of Hebrew prayers, prayers that seemed to fill up the temple ceiling above me. Now, despite their predictable tune, at just 5 years old, these were prayers that I couldn't yet understand. Now, after services, I do remember taking a walk with my two moms in the large park just a few blocks away from our synagogue. All of us were still dressed in the distinctly Jewish clothing, kippahs and tallises, that we wore to services. Every year, the three of us would make a long circle around the park. And to this day, those walks after synagogue are some of my happiest and most meaningful memories. Just recently, though, another Jewish family was taking a similar walk in Lower Manhattan's Battery Park in New York City. The family passed by a man who, seeing that the family was wearing clearly Jewish clothing, clothing similar to what my family wore on our walk through the park, turned around and drew a knife from his coat. The man slashed both parents and their one-year-old child all across their faces. Now, I would never have been able to comprehend a story like that at the age that I was in those early memories. But now I understand that that family truly could have been my family. Now, after I had my bar mitzvah when I was 13 years old, I loved to go to regular Saturday morning services in my synagogue. By that time, I could understand what the prayers meant, and I probably loved to attend those services more than anyone else in my family. But I would try to get them to come along as often as I could. By that time, I have a little sister, and she is 5 years old. Every Saturday, I incentivize her to get up early and walk to services with me, usually with the promise of some pastry, treat, or ice cream later in the afternoon. Now, every Saturday, we would get up and walk to services together, and if my friends were there, she would usually sit with us. But if more of her friends were there than mine, she would ask if she could run off and go sit with them across the room. Now, obviously, I preferred when she sat with me, but regardless, those mornings in synagogue with her are absolutely the most meaningful mornings that I have ever had. Every week, synagogue was a grounding highlight for me. But the morning of October 27th, 2018, everything changes. Because that morning I read that a gunman had entered the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and fatally shot 11 Jewish worshipers. I read that the victims were sitting peacefully in Saturday morning synagogue before they were murdered. Services just like those that I looked forward to so much every week, and just like those that I planned to attend on that very day. Now, every day that I go to synagogue after that, I can't sit still. I listen to the daily teachings and I sing along as best I can to the prayers in Hebrew, but no matter what I do, I find my eyes darting around the room, darting at the exits. I look at the exit in front of me, adjacent to the podium where the rabbi stands. I turn around and I look at the exit behind my head, closer but more open. And I wonder, which one will I run to if a gunman enters the room and starts shooting? Will it be quicker to dart forward, ducking behind chairs and benches as I try to make an escape, or more effective to turn around and run for the closer exit behind my head? Now, regardless, I was terrified. And out of all these plans, all of these blueprints for survival that I felt like I had to make at just 13 years old, there's one that I remember more clearly than any of the rest. And it's probably the most important. As I heard the Saturday morning prayers fill up the room above me, and I tried desperately to sit still in my chair and feel grounded, my mind's eye was filled with chaos. In my mind's eye, I saw bullets flying. I saw them tearing through the synagogue's plaster walls, ripping through the wooden table on which the Torah rested. I heard them shattering the stained glass windows of the synagogue on either sides of the room. And I wonder, With bullets flying and bodies cluttering the floor, would I have time to run across the room, grab my little sister in my arms, and take her to safety without the both of us being killed? I was 13 years old, and I couldn't sit for 5 minutes in what used to be my place of safety, not without planning on how I might have to save my little sister from death. I was so, so scared. And in 2018, after the Tree of Life synagogue shooting, many Jews in the country were thinking along similar lines. That year, Jews made up around 2% of the American domestic population. But despite being such a tiny minority, nearly 60% of religiously based hate crimes targeted Jews. That year, there were nearly 1,300 of these crimes. But anti-Semitism in our country has actually only gotten worse since 2018. In 2019, there were nearly 1,000 anti-Semitic hate crimes committed against the Jewish people alone. Now, that's an average of nearly 3 every single day. That's 3 hate crimes committed against the tiny Jewish minority of the United States every day with no days off for a year. And despite 18 months of lockdowns and restrictions, anti-Semitism in our country has actually remained at near record levels until now. In fact, however likely I was as a scared 13-year-old kid in synagogue, or any other Jewish person in the country was to be the victim of a hate crime in 2018, we would be even more likely to be a victim of that hate crime today. Over 10% more likely, according to the Anti-Defamation League. Now, this increase in anti-Semitic hate does not stand alone. It's part of an identifiable statistical trend. 4 out of the last 5 years, there has been an increase in the number of hate crimes in our country at large, an increase right in step with the increase in anti-Jewish hate crimes. Now, this statistic is seldom reported or analyzed on a national stage, but that doesn't make it any less true. It still tells us something. Especially when you consider that when the amount of anti-Jewish crimes were decreasing in our country, say from 2008 to 2013, the number of total hate crimes were decreasing right in step with them. The data shows us clearly, more clearly than we ever have imagined, that anti-Semitism, the fight against anti-Semitism, is an intersectional fight. It's a fight for everyone. Now, it's no easy task, and it never has been. It's no short road. But ultimately, it's a road that must be taken together. Crushing domestic anti-Semitism is something that we can do in the 21st century. It's a fight that we can win. Now, how can we win it? Well, firstly, through education. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, is a subordinate branch of the UN that focuses on shaping international educational policy. Now, UNESCO has determined the number one most effective tool that most of its member states have to combat anti-Semitism. Now, they've determined that that tool is education. It's time for the United States, with this conclusion drawn, to utilize education, especially through calculated reform of history and ethnic studies curriculums, to combat anti-Semitism in our country. Now, how best do we go about doing this? Through targeting ignorance. The myths of Jewish hegemonic pursuit and the undue possession of power in Jewish hands have proved central to anti-Semitic dogma in our country time and time again. But these are myths that education has the power to dispel. By educating our nation's students on the history of the Jewish diaspora's continued oppression, when Jews were expelled from England in 1290, murdered in Spain in 1492, slaughtered in the pogroms of Eastern Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries, and tortured in the Holocaust, we can dispel the myths that the Jewish people control too much power in our society. We can dispel the myth that the Jewish people are an enemy to be feared. These are myths that are based off ignorance. And the best thing that we can do to fight ignorance is ramp up our anti-Semitism education. Now, ignorance often fuels hatred, and hatred often fuels violence. So no matter how simple this education may seem, no matter how early we start, it will be the first step to fighting not only casual anti-Semitism, but extremist anti-Semitism overall. Now, structural changes, especially in our education systems, are crucial. But on a personal level, fighting anti-Semitism is something that we can do as well. Now, right now, it's no secret that many of us are stretched incredibly thin. It's burdensome to think about taking on another part of our society that we need to examine, another cause to fight for, another goal to care about. But I believe that combating anti-Semitism is a responsibility that all of us share. It's a moral imperative for every one of us. And by far, the most common forms of anti-Semitism in our country is not murders or assaults, but less conspicuous, everyday forms of discrimination and harassment. Now, this casual anti-Semitism, if left unchecked, has the potential to evolve into real acts of hatred and violence. Casualism evolves into extremism. That's why it's the job of all of us to stand up to anti-Semitism when others stand down, to combat all types of anti-Semitic hate that we see in our daily lives. Because for many of us, we know that we see it. Silence is always complacency. And that does not just go for fighting anti-Semitism. The data shows us that the safety of the Jewish community in the United States is deeply linked with the safety of nearly every other oppressed group in our country. A desire to harm Jews in our nation is deeply linked with a desire to harm the Black community, a desire to harm the Muslim community, a desire to harm the LGBTQ community, and a desire to harm the Asian community. And we all would be foolish if we thought that that's where the list stopped. Fighting anti-Semitism intersectionally should be the goal that we all have. And like I said before, it is truly an achievable one. As history has shown us, a society that tolerates hate against Jews is never a society that just tolerates hate against Jews. It's a society that tolerates hate. This was as true in 1943 as it is today. But unlike the Jews of 1943, we all have an opportunity. Through education and personally combating every type of anti-Semitism and every type of hate that we see in our lives, we have an opportunity to build a society where hate has no room to fester in any of its forms. In this time, we have the opportunity, we have the resources to build a society where parents do not have to fear for the lives of their children, and where brothers do not have to fear for the lives of their sisters. Our collective work of fighting anti-Semitism will build a society that does better. Better for everyone. Thank you.
That young man is wise beyond his years. But, you know, hate gets us nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. And
I agree. Which, by the way, you know, I talked about New York. We talk about New York all the time. New York is a home to the largest numbers of Jewish hate crimes. Which, as you and I talked about in the past, FBI in their latest report didn't include the statistics of all the hate crimes against Jews in New York or LA, which was just crazy. And we talked about the fact that the mass majority of these hate crimes, violent hate crimes against Jews in New York City, have gone unprosecuted. I think a lot of people were really angry this past week with the Manhattan DA's office, which is responsible for the prosecution of these acts. There was a man, Wasim Awada, who had been offered a plea deal by the Manhattan DA. He is an individual who was charged with a hate crime for attacking a yarmulke wearing Jewish man in May of 2021, who was known as saying, quote, "If I could do it again, I would do it again." And they pretty much gave him a little slap on the hand and an easy plea deal for the violent attack. And I think it's just, this is a perfect example of why people are getting.
I mean, the yarmulke on the head is almost like a target for hate groups.
Well,
and so many Orthodox Jews in New York do wear head coverings, and they become targets. And as you and I have talked, the prosecutions have been dreadfully low, just dreadfully low.
And I, you know, look, I mean, there's such a large Orthodox community in New York, and look, the Orthodox community in this nation bears the brunt of the violent anti-Semitic attacks because
absolutely
they're the most visible, and we need to pay attention to it. We need to be hearing their concerns. I find it deeply concerning that the city of New York is still failing to respond to the crimes being committed. And if somebody who's a Jew hater knows, like, I can get away with a violent attack and get a slap on the wrist or nothing at all, like, what's the deterrent? I don't know. And I, you know, that this is, you know, we have a mayor now in New York City who I know is a good friend of the Jewish community, you know,
and the former, a former cop.
He is, but, you know, he doesn't have control over the DA's office, right?
Right.
The prosecution's office is going to do what they're going to do. And I think that's disappointing. I mean, I'd like to see more pressure from the leadership in New York City to actually prosecute these hate crimes. I mean, hate is hate. And, you know, if you're going to be against one form of racism, then you need to be against all forms of racism. And you need to make sure that these hate crimes against the Jews are being prosecuted. So,
and we ought to say, both of you and I know you from being an attorney and me from all my reporting years, that the DA's office, or here it's the state attorney's office, and the police department don't always get along, or they do on the TV shows. And that's not always the case. So that is part of the problem. I want to take a left turn to across the sea to Israel, what's going on with the Netanyahu government and the protests going on in Israel. I have a huge concern, as you know, I don't like Netanyahu, but about with this new proposal that the Knesset could overrule the Supreme Court with 61 votes. To me, that makes my head spin, Laureen.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I think what Benjamin Netanyahu said is, you know, look, let's have a debate over it. Let's have a discussion over it. There were some extraordinary reforms done in the 1990s, which dramatically expanded the power of the judiciary in Israel. And he's saying, you know, maybe we need to stop and reflect on that and take a look on it. And it was part of the platform they ran on, the Likud ran on, was, you know, reforming the judiciary. And he's saying it's not a done deal. Let's have a conversation over it. Let's, you know, there's legislation proposed, but let's have an open debate about it, because obviously people voted on the issue and we need to have a conversation about it. So I think it's fine to have a conversation about it, if that, you know, especially if you want to look at something that you did in the 90s and say, did this accomplish what we want to accomplish? I mean, to say that somehow it's the end of democracy and what some people are doing that is pretty radical is insane. I mean, there was, for those of you who read about it, a huge protest yesterday in Israel regarding this, mass demonstrations. But what's really interesting about it is that a lot of the people that were there in these mass demonstrations were anti-Zionist, pro-Palestinians, hated Israel, and are being funded by a U.S.-based NGO,
non-governmental organization.
Which is a left-wing organization called New Israel Fund the New Israel Fund is known for financially supporting organizations that support the language that Israel engages in.
But there were some protests. There are some people that are upset with the Netanyahu government, including former Prime Minister Yair Lapid, who talked and said the people should protest. Benny Gantz, who said that the people should protest.
That's fine. I think the problem is that when you see these mass protests and you have U.S.-based left-wing NGOs who hate Israel, who support the lies of apartheid and genocide, bringing people out there. You see mass Israel Palestinian flags out at these protests. And then you have the Israeli comedian who was in Qatar, who was, you know, subjected to horrific anti-Semitic attacks in Qatar, saying he was more scared there in Tel Aviv with some of these crazy protesters than he was in Qatar. That you've got to stop and say, wait a second, who's behind these protests? You need to think about that. And the U.S. media is not going to talk about that, but we need to talk about it. But we definitely need to keep an eye on it and see what happens in Israel. I think, look, there are obviously real concerns about overhauling the judiciary, but I don't think there's a problem with having a debate about it. I think if you're a democracy, you should be able to have an open conversation about it without, you know, threats of tyranny and, you know, overrunning the government or whatever. I think they should be able to have a conversation and say, were these reforms right? Should we reconsider? But we'll see what happens. I don't know.
I am concerned about it. Another thing that both you and I are concerned about are relationships between the Jewish community and the African-American community.
Absolutely.
And we talked a couple of weeks ago, before the first of the year, to NPR critic Eric Deggans, media critic Eric Deggans. And we have part two of that coming up right after this. This is The Third Opinion. That interview in just a moment. But have you looked at our webpage, where you can listen to previous editions of The Third Opinion podcast, find out more about our hosts, and leave a comment or two? And now, back to The Third Opinion podcast and that interview. Welcome back to The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
I'm Lorraine Jaffe.
And we're on WKDWN, the podcast. And as we mentioned before the break, Eric Deggans used to work for the Tampa Bay Times. He was TV and media critic. He now works for NPR as the media critic and TV analyst. And we started the conversation off talking about Dave Chappelle and his tropes against Jews, and then Kanye West. And we got into just the relationship between Jews and the African-American community. And I thought it was important we pick it up. We start off, though, with Dave Chappelle. And here is Eric Deggans.
But I think ultimately, I'm not sure that there's much that Jewish people can do about the conversation that Black people are having about anti-Semitism, because it's something we kind of have to solve. And, you know, that's why I'm speaking out so much about what Dave Chappelle and people like him are doing, because, you know, ultimately what this does is it breaks up a historic alliance
right.
that was used to advance civil rights for both groups, and it winds up serving the interests of the people who hate both groups.
Right, exactly, right.
And you know, Chappelle is willing again to kind of feed this idea that you know, that Black people somehow get the short end of the stick in these alliances, but I don't think that's true. And I think the alternative is terrible. So, you know, it's a tough issue to navigate, but I think the one thing that we all have to do is make sure that we don't jump to conclusions about what other people are doing. You know, if somebody, because there's tension about Kanye West and Kyrie Irving and Dave Chappelle, don't let that make you treat a Black person in your life differently, unless they've earned it.
That is great advice.
That
sort of focuses on what we should do. But should we speak out and criticize the people that are doing it? That's the other. And I'm not only Kanye, because of the metal problems, right, and all, but even Chappelle.
Well, I mean, of course, and like I say, you know, what Kanye said deserves to be criticized. I'm just sparing a little bit of compassion for the idea that he might be in the middle of a mental health crisis, and that he might be enabled by all these people who don't have his best interests at heart. I'm not saying that to excuse anything he's doing, and everything he's saying should be condemned. And I don't have any criticism of people who feel the need to publicly condemn him for what he's saying, because they're right. But I'm just saying, at the end of it, like, there's something else going on with him. This is not, we can't pretend that he just woke up one day and decided to speak vociferously and publicly about how much he loves Hitler, and that there isn't something connected to his struggles with mental health. I think we're fooling ourselves about that. I mean, you know, we just went through this period where we had a bunch of documentaries come out that essentially said, you know, we had one take on a celebrity that wasn't fair, that was rooted in stereotypes, and because of that, that celebrity was damaged and hurt. So, you know, we had the Surviving R. Kelly, this docuseries, right, come out, and it sort of made the argument that, you know, news about R. Kelly's predations on young women surfaced 25 years ago, and the pop culture world kind of shrugged it off, and he was still winning Grammys, and people still bought his records, and people just kind of acted like...
it's like Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, really.
But I'm talking more about, like, sort of the court of pop culture opinion.
Was that, know, it was okay, yeah.
The court of pop culture opinion decided to ignore, you know, this very real evidence that R. Kelly was, you know, a predator.
Right.
And let him get away with what he was doing for quite a while. We had a documentary about Britney Spears that suggested that the way that we talked about her mental health issues, or the way that we talked about, you know, her activities as a mother, or the way that we talked about her sexuality as a young girl and pop star, where it was all sort of wrapped up in all these stereotypes that we had about women, and that it was pretty unfair and sexist. And it wound up, she wound up being placed inside a conservancy for years. So on the other end of all of that, now we're faced with Kanye West doing what he's doing. And it just says to me, you know, we got to be careful about, you know, how we're judging him and how we're going to react to him. And, you know, I think number one, you got to condemn what he's saying. Number two, you got to stop putting him out in the media, you know. So even if Alex Jones is willing to have him on his show, we got to figure out a way to keep that from resulting in 50 million headlines all over, you know, TV and newspapers.
But Jones has so many followers. I mean,
he does have followers. But I mean, you know, Alex Jones is going to say what he's going to say.
Right.
At some point, it is more damaging to focus on what Kanye is saying and broadcast it, you know, far and wide. When this, you know, in Kanye's case, you know, this is a guy who seems to be in the middle of a mental health crisis. Now, if Nick Fuentes, who's part of an organization, goes on a podcast and starts saying this stuff, then you have a sense that there is action behind those words. This is not just somebody decompensating in public. This is somebody speaking publicly about a strategy, you know, that they're implementing. And that's to be taken a different way. But I think, you know, ultimately, you know, making a big deal out of every anti-Semitic thing that Kanye West says publicly, you know, like putting it in the front of TV news shows and putting it on the front page of newspapers, you know, backfires, you know, and winds up doing more damage than anything. So we have to figure out how to sort of approach these pop culture issues in a way that makes sense, and in a way that limits how they damage, you know, our ability to connect with each other, you know, because ultimately I think that's the biggest damage that somebody like Kanye West creates. And Dave Chappelle encouraged that in a way that is not helpful, you know. Encouraging people to take sides on this issue when there's really only one side.
Right. You know? Yeah, not good people on both sides, as someone who we won't mention said.
Well, yeah, not only that, not even that, but, you know, just, you know, to have a monologue that sort of minimizes the impact of what, you know, Kanye West did or what Kyrie Irving did.
Yeah. But Chappelle, he had a show where, I don't know if I used to watch his show all the time when he was on, where he had the N family. Do you remember that? I heard, my son was watching it. I ran in to change the channel. Really, I was in the other room. I said, what are you watching? He said, oh, it's just Chappelle. I mean, this was years ago. I mean, but it was, I found it offensive in the other room. I'm honest to God, I have never said that word out loud. I don't use that word. It really bugs me. And I'm hearing this from the other room that my son is watching. I'm going, what the hell are you doing? You know?
Right. But, you know, in that case, he, right or wrong, he's trying to sort of explore the nature of having a sequence of syllables be verboten in society and how absurd that can be on some level.
Yeah, no, I get it. But man, it made my head spin, you know?
So. Well, that was the intended, that was the intended effect.
It worked. It worked. It worked for me.
To shock people your age and to make people who are younger sort of seeing something subversive and dangerous.
Yeah. He is a bright guy, and as I mentioned last time he was on, he grew up in Gary, Indiana, and went to a Jewish school. He's African American for, I don't know, through sixth grade, he told me. So that's pretty interesting. Yeah. And I've known Eric for a long time, and when he told me that during the interview, I was like, whoa.
Well, I think that's the whole idea, is just being exposed to each other and each other's cultures and having conversations and understanding each other's struggles. And that, you know, I don't know. I again, you know, the Torah teaches us that we're all created in Hashem's image and likeness, and we all have to go through the human experience. And every person, no matter what their background, no matter what their color, religion, race, et cetera, is, we all have to experience life, and life is not easy. Like,
that's right. During the same week, we celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday. That's right. That is the perfect message.
Yeah. I mean, everybody goes through challenges, and we have to be empathetic to those challenges, because you never know when it's going to be you. But speaking of media, I mean, Christiane Amanpour, I mean, I am so horrified by her treatment. It was so disgraceful. So she was interviewing the filmmaker, Dror Mora. He's an Israeli director, and he did The Corridors of Power, a movie that talks about Ukraine, the Holocaust, Bosnia, Kosovo, Syria, etc. And Amanpour began to ask him about Syria, and she says, quote, to Mora, "You are an Israeli. I don't know whether you were in Israel at the time, but you said that this red line in the neighborhood and the neighboring country of Syria, where all these atrocities are being committed, really, really made you angry and upset. Many will want to know, you know, do you feel that angry about the horrible situation that's going on in your own country and the human rights attacks killing Palestinians? I mean, obviously we know Israelis, you know, are attacked, but what is your perspective as an Israeli, given the whole never again paradigm in which you place this investigation?" End quote. Oh my God. Just stop for a moment and think about what you just said.
You know what surprises me about her reports, which are so slanted, that an editor doesn't say, "Wait a second, you can't say that." I mean, I couldn't say something like that without one of my producers being all over my case, or the attorneys that we had to run everything by. It always boggles my mind how she can get such a slanted report on the air.
I mean, just think about that for a minute. She is comparing it. So Assad, who
was murdering his own people with gas, murdering his own
gassing his own people And like, well, you know, you had a problem with that. You have a problem with Israel. Like, what is Israel doing, Christiane? I'm sorry, because the last time I checked, you know, Israel, the Israelis just suffered, you know, the largest attacks on civilians since they had since the last second intifada this past year, with countless violent murders and assaults and terrorist attacks on civilians. Like, I mean, Israel's not out killing. Like, I just don't even understand the question. It is,
I know.
And really, all it does is go back to what she, this is the point. She is out there tainting. Think of all these viewers, millions of viewers watching CNN, listening to what she's saying, going, oh, wow. Yeah, what do you have to say about that, Dror? I'm just sort of curious, Dror Mora. What do you have to say about that? You know, no, they're just taking it for the truth. They're taking what she's saying as like, somehow what she's saying is true. There's nobody challenging the truth of it. It's just this massively laced.
It is so slanted. Oh. Okay. How about on the other end of the media coin, I've got to give a shout out to Chris Berman, the sportscaster inducted into the Jewish Hall of Fame. He's the one, if you don't know, who would go, he's going to go all the way. Yeah. And then now he's doing some kind of goofy commercials for, I don't know, insurance on your car or whatever. But I've got a great story about Chris Berman.
Geico, here's why, you think Geico commercials now, right?
Here is why I really like Chris Berman. Several years ago, the Bucks were in a playoff game, and everybody was down here to cover it, as we were at the TV station. And I was in the stands getting ready to do a stand-up where you see the reporter on camera. And Chris Berman was down a couple of rows doing the same type of thing for his report that was going to air on the network. And he saw me standing there, and he looked at me and went, hey, you local? I went, yeah. He said, your deadline's before mine. Go ahead. Have at it.
Nice.
So I thought that was the coolest thing. You know, he hadn't forgotten, you know, what it was like to be the local guy, and his deadline was until 6:50. Mine was at 6 o'clock or something like that. So I will forever respect Chris Berman, even though he's doing the goofy commercials now. But I think it's a car warranty thing. Yeah. Huh?
He's making some good money now, probably.
Yeah, you got to make a buck here and there. But really, I'm so thrilled he's in the Hall of Fame, because he was and is an exciting announcer and deserves it.
I agree. I mean, look, I grew up watching football with my brother, so I
know who he is. That's right.
I know him well. I do want to mention, I got two positive stories I want to talk about, but first I just want to mention this, because, you know, I've talked about this. Like, again, most people are not aware, especially Jews, of the illegal Palestinian settlements. No. So the latest one, the Palestinian Authority is getting ready to build a new settlement on the ruins of Joshua's altar in Samaria. So for those of you, this altar specifically.
Some people don't know about the altar.
So Joshua, for those of you who don't recall, when Moses died, Joshua led the Jewish people into Israel. We crossed the Jordan River and then, you know, went into Israel. And when we went into Israel after the Battle of Ai, so there's Jericho and then Ai, Joshua did what he was directed to do by Moses, which was to build an altar. And he had the entire nation of Israel stand on two mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And Deuteronomy chapter 8 or Devarim 28, that we in the Torah, says there's two things. There are the blessings that were pronounced from one mountain in the law, and then the curses that were pronounced from the other mountain. And Joshua built an altar to Hashem on Mount Ebal. So it was Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim where the blessings and the curses of the law were read. And the Palestinian Authority plans on building this beautiful, lush neighborhood over the archaeological ruins of the actual altar, which exists. The altar, there's archaeological ruins that demonstrate the existence of this altar built by Joshua on Mount Ebal. They plan on building this beautiful new settlement on top of the archaeological site, and in essence, eliminating the existence of that site, so people cannot return to it and know the proof of Joshua going there and doing that. And just, again, the historical importance of that and how important that
the
was.
Disrespect.
You know, there's blessing and curse. Choose this day. You know, I put before you this day, life and death, choose life, blessing and curse. You know, it was a really important moment after we had crossed over the Jordan into the land. And that, to me, I'm like so upset about that. If they go forward with that settlement, I am just beyond upset. But really important. Yeah. It's like people don't know about this. But I thought too, great. The Fablemans. Did you watch the movie The Fablemans?
We have not seen it yet. That is on my list. We saw the Tom Hanks movie last night. Otto.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that one yet. But I will say, so those of you who don't know, Steven Spielberg, good Jewish boy. He just won the Golden Globe for his movie, The Fablemans. It was the best drama. And so Scott and I watched it, and it was amazing. We love this movie. It was awesome. It was just like
I really want to. I love Spielberg.
I can't wait till you see the movie, because there's a scene in the movie that we were just dying over. It was just hilarious. And so I want you to see the movie, Mike, so we could talk about it. But for those of you who didn't, I think you can get it on Netflix or whatever right now. We got it. So just go.
Oh, it's on Netflix. So I thought you had to go to the theater. Can you buy it on Netflix?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we watched it we rented it and watched it from home. So I don't know.
Okay, cool. You're not doing anything illegal there, Laureen, to get the movie. No.
I thought the other release, I mean, I love the late Righteous Memory, the chief rabbi, former chief rabbi of the UK, Rabbi Sacks. You know, there's this wonderful story this week about him. I guess it came out because
Prince Harry.
Right. So Harry, the Duke of Sussex, I guess his new book had some commentary about him, about the rabbi. And so I guess Harry had, Prince Harry had worn a Nazi costume to a party in 2005. And his father strongly rebuked him and sent him. He said, you need to go see the chief rabbi. And so now King Charles has sent his son at the time to go see the chief rabbi, Lord Jonathan Sacks. And Lord Jonathan Sacks, you know, rebuked him, but at the same time, in a way that only he could, made it a learning lesson. And you know, it was really wonderful because, you know, Prince Harry in his book, you know, spoke very fondly and lovingly of the rabbi and just, you know, being this extraordinary intellectual, spiritual leader and thinker who really, you know, didn't shame him, didn't really condemn him, rebuked him, but then used as a learning moment for him. And I just thought that was just so wonderful. And I think it's just so true. You know, one of the reasons why I just still to this day love listening to his.
No, he's true. Okay, Laureen, we have about a minute left. I'm going to give you a subject. I'm going to let you run until I interrupt you, because I know you dislike TikTok, as it is, because all sorts of things. It takes 75 minutes for anti-Semitic tropes to appear to anyone's new on TikTok. Take it, Laureen.
Oh my God. I guess this goes to the point of why nobody should be on TikTok. I mean, anti-Semitism runs rampant on social media. It has for many years. We know this. I mean, whether it's TikTok, Facebook, Twitter, whatever. I mean, it's just another reason why if your child has TikTok on their phone, take it off. Like, forget China for a moment, which should be a million reasons why regarding China you shouldn't have TikTok. But this, again, just get rid of it. It's garbage. It's absolute garbage that is just destroying your child.
And anti-Semitism reigns supreme. That's your softball for the year, Laureen. And we hear that music.
Only for 2023.
Out of time. This is The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
Great Jaffe.
Bye. That's our show for this week. Hope you'll join us again next week. And don't forget, subscribe to the Third Opinion Podcast wherever you get your podcast. And thanks for listening.